So our next speaker comes to us from NYU. He is Zach Kahn. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon there and is heavily involved in the lung transplant and ECMO programs.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Congress for the opportunity to come talk about this topic. I will warn everyone, I am not a general surgeon, so please forgive me if I muck up the abdominal compartment component. The main talk, no disclosures relevant to this talk. So the main point of this talk is to describe situations where classic teaching in general surgery, both in when and who to operate on, and equally important, when and who not to operate on, don't necessarily apply. And that many times is the case when a patient is supported with extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO, whether it is for cardiac support, pulmonary, or cardiopulmonary support. So just to set things off, always nice to, I think, start with a case. So it was a 29-year-old who aspirated during induction of anesthesia for a gallbladder. His pH when I was called to the operating room was 715. His peak airway pressures were nearly 40. They tried to do their best with what they had with a PEEP of 18 and a rate of 32, but despite that was hypercapnic and hypoxic. However, being a young, healthy individual, was on no pressors, and TEE performed in the operating room demonstrated completely normal cardiac function. So he's cannulated for VV ECMO via the right groin and right IJ, there was significant difficulty advancing the venous cannula beyond 30 centimeters. No obvious signs of injury or issue, but just couldn't get the cannula up to where we normally would place it. The hours following this, the patient was transferred to the ICU and just had persistent low flow. We weren't able to maintain an adequate flow to support him from an oxygenation standpoint. And because of continuous chatter, large volumes of fluid were administered to this patient and got a little bit away from the ICU team. And 24 hours later, he was over 8 liters positive on top of what he had already gone in the operating room. This was his x-ray the next morning. Sorry, it doesn't project super well. Despite that, he still had progressive difficulty maintaining adequate flow and obviously had declining tidal volumes on his similar ventilatory settings, unable now to ventilate or oxygenate him. He did have a very modest pressure requirement, but again, hemodynamics was really not his ongoing issue. At this time, his belly was found to be fairly distended, although it was not taut in the classic sense. Bladder pressures were measured consistently between 17 and 19. Of note is renal function and hepatic function were all normal. His lactate was in the 2 range, so relatively unremarkable. So the question is, what's the next step? How do we fix the issue here of low flow in a hypoxic and hypercapnic patient with the ARDS who has intra-abdominal hypertension, but no clear evidence of abdominal compartment syndrome? So moving over to ECMO for a second, why does this matter to the vast majority of people? It's because ECMO has exponentially growth in utilization over the past decade. While the absolute number per center has increased, more importantly, the number of centers offering ECMO has equally increased at the same logarithmic rate. And because of that, more and more intensivist and general surgeons will be seeing patients treated with ECMO and therefore need to have a keen understanding of how it works and how things may, again, differ from standard dogma surrounding when and when not to operate on patients. Breaking down the circuit a little bit, ECMO actually is fairly simple. There's a pump. The vast majority of pumps now are centrifugal, either partially levitated or fully magnetically levitated systems. There's an oxygenator that both instills oxygen and decarboxylates the blood via sweep gas. There's a drainage limb, which is most commonly placed in a femoral vein. And there's a return limb after it goes through the pump and the oxygenator with oxygenated and decarboxylated blood to return this blood to the patient. The pump itself is, again, a almost universally a centrifugal pump, which has an excellent functional status. However, by design, these are highly preload and afterload dependent systems, and that comes into play particularly in settings of moderate to low preload and increased afterload. These are just three variations on ECMO, so the only thing that's changed here is not the circuit, not the pump, not the oxygenator, but just where the cannulas are placed. So in this first example, this is veno-arterial ECMO, which would predominantly be used for cardiac support. In this case, a common femoral artery can peripherally be cannulated. And then either the ipsilateral or contralateral common femoral vein can be cannulated. That cannula would then be advanced up to the level of the RA-IVC junction, or at least the hepatic confluence for drainage. Next to it is a VV or veno-venous ECMO configuration. And in this case, the venous cannula again would be advanced through the common femoral vein up the IVC to the RA-IVC junction. But the return cannula of oxygenated blood would be returned to the right IJ, and this would only offer pulmonary support as there's no arterial outflow. This last one is in a small, is similar to the other VV system, except both of the cannulas are placed via the groin. One is placed for drainage, which again would be advanced via one of the common femoral veins up to the heart, and the other would be placed just beyond that with return from that cannula. So this is termed fem-fem veno-venous ECMO. This was mentioned in the last talk. Alternatively, there can be a single site cannulation where a cannula is placed via the right IJ. These are large port cannulas that then transverse the right atrium. There's a drainage component in the IVC as well as the SVC, and then there's a side port that delivers returned oxygenated blood to the right atrium. Again, this would be for primarily respiratory support, not cardiac. These are examples of venous drainage cannulas, and I think it's important to just understand what these look like in order to have an understanding of the different issues that can happen when you have venous drainage problems. So this is an older cannula. It's the Medtronic Biomedicus. As you can see, it's a wire-reinforced long cannula with a tip that is perforated in several places to allow drainage, but there's no other drainage site along the cannula. So if this area is occluded, then you'll have zero drainage from this cannula. This is a slightly more recent rendition of the same cannulas, which has drainage at the tip, similarly to the previous cannula, but also has multiple perforations along its length to allow continuous drainage along the length of the IVC. And there are now more recent cannulas, both from Medtronic, McKay, as well as other companies, that have progressively improved on this and decreased the risk of obstruction from IVC collapse. Getting back to intra-abdominal hypertension and abdominal compartment syndrome, so again, as a cardiac surgeon, I'm not going to lecture the American College of Surgeons on what it is, but the important aspects in regards to ECMO is as the diaphragm rises, it increases, decreases pulmonary compliance, worsening ventilatory parameters. Additionally, it causes increased IVC compression within the belly, decreasing venous return. There's also direct compression of the heart, decreasing cardiac output. And importantly, in respiratory failure patients who are hypoxic and hypercapnic, there can also be an increase in ICP, which is exacerbated in these patients relative to patients with only suffering from abdominal compartment syndrome. I'm not going to go through the slide. I really just put it up here to demonstrate that a tremendous amount of great work has already been done looking at abdominal compartment syndrome, both in an algorithm to identify it as well as when to intervene and how to follow those patients. And as a result, there are relatively clear guidelines for when a laparotomy should be performed on which patient and when observation is appropriate. And the point of this talk, again, is to try and divorce some of these ideas that algorithms don't necessarily apply to ECMO patients, or at least some variation of them has to be taken into account when dealing with these complex patients. So now dealing with a patient with intra-abdominal hypertension and ECMO, and again, not necessarily abdominal compartment syndrome, so normal end organ function, but progressive elevation in their belly pressure. You can see as the intra-abdominal pressure is low or normal, there's an expected high ECMO flow as blood is drained by this venous cannula coming through the IVC. However, as venous compression from the intra-abdominal hypertension progresses, one can expect a progressive decrease in ECMO flow. And this is both as a result of just overall decreased venous return from the lower extremities because of the intra-abdominal hypertension, as well as direct obstruction of those side holes in the cannula from the IVC wall compressed up against it. This obviously then can lead to insufficient flow to support these patients and persistent hypoxia, or in the case of veno-arterial ECMO and cardiac support, insufficient hemodynamics. So predominantly in the pediatric literature, this has been looked at in small series or case reports. This first report was in 2006, and this is a very highly complex congenital heart patient supported by veno-arterial ECMO who developed subsequent abdominal compartment syndrome. Laparotomy was performed, however, that patient ultimately died. This was followed by several other publications with similar outcomes. And the important part of all of these cases is abdominal compartment syndrome was the indication for intervention, not intra-abdominal hypertension, not decreased venous return and insufficient ECMO flow, which is an important thing to keep in mind when we talk about further cases. This is yet another much larger series, and again, large in the world of ECMO is small, so a series of seven patients with 100% mortality where decompressive laparotomy for abdominal compartment syndrome in children was offered. A distinction to adult ECMO that's important is cannulation for children typically is done via the neck. So venous obstruction from the IVC compressing the cannulas is less common, so you can imagine that this is a very advanced stage of abdominal compartment syndrome to warrant intervention. So what about in adults? Well, an initial assessment two adults with abdominal compartment syndrome also had similar poor outcomes. However, of note, these patients were quite far along and had persistent abdominal compartment syndrome for a progressive period of time. And ultimately died not of respiratory failure, but the pathologic process leading to their abdominal compartment syndrome in the first place. This last case is actually a successful foray into intervention. Again, the difference being an earlier intervention when truly it was really just intra-abdominal hypertension and no longer frank abdominal compartment syndrome for this patient. So we looked back. This was when I was still at University of Maryland at our experience. This was over a 4 or 5 year period where we had done around 600 something ECMOs. And nine patients undergoing veno-venous ECMO were identified, and that accounts to about 1 to 3% of all cases. So while not a large number, not a negligible a number either. And the reason for ECMO in most of these patients was ARDS. Some of them were intraoperative support for lung transplantation. The etiology of their abdominal compartment syndrome was thought to be fluid resuscitation for the vast majority of them, and in some cases, intra-abdominal bleeding. And actually, only in two cases was frank ischemia discovered at the time of laparotomy. Pre-ECMO, these patients were quite sick with elevated Murray scores, low PF ratios, poor compliance. Of note, being at a very aggressive ECMO center, the time from intubation to ECMO was quite short in these patients, and early intervention was employed. The vast majority of these patients were on inhaled pulmonary vasodilators as well as paralyzed. So our surgical approach, this is a picture of a mini mitral that went awry and developed progressive abdominal compartment syndrome. Midline laparotomy was performed with evisceration of the bowel. I'd like to say this was the same setting, but this was several days later after multiple washouts to get to this state. However, the point here is, despite the convoluted nature of being on veno arterial ECMO, the intervention both can be warranted and be beneficial. This patient ultimately went on to go home and is still doing quite well. Of importance, the preferred closure method, at least at University of Maryland at the time, was progressive washouts and closure with a vacuum-assisted dressing. This allowed less respiratory and hemodynamic, as well as drainage sequelae of the belly closing itself. So while I said most of these patients had intra-abdominal hypertension, many of them did in fact have a bladder pressure over 20 or 25. ECMO to laparotomy was on average 3 days, which is pretty consistent with the initial case we presented. The ECMO flow saw significant improvement, as well as the PF ratio from pre to post laparotomy, as well as the pulmonary compliance. So not only does it help you support the patient through improving venous return to the ECMO circuit and oxygenation that way, but actually the pulmonary function, not having that decreased compliance because of the elevated diaphragm, is helpful. These patients overall did quite well. The ECMO duration was around 2 weeks, a hospital length of stay around a month. 50% underwent tracheostomy. I have to say now probably 100% would receive a tracheostomy, as our preferred course for ECMO is an early tracheostomy on day three. And abdominal closure was successful in the vast majority of patients. An important note is the abdominal closure was still done on ECMO. We did initially trial doing this after we weaned patients off ECMO. The benefit of that, obviously, is being fully off anticoagulation. However, that's usually met with decompensation, so we've preferred to do it again while they're still on ECMO in a controlled setting, watch them a couple days, and then decannulate them. The time from laparotomy to closure was also around 2 weeks, and the outcomes actually were quite good. They're commensurate with the ELSO published data for all comers for veno-venous ECMO support, which is 58% in the ELSO registry and 56% in this cohort. I just want to finish by touching on a couple specific considerations for ECMO, and I kind of added this in at the end because it's really true of any surgical intervention we do on a patient on ECMO, and not specific to abdominal compartment syndrome, which again I was hoping to just serve as an example of something that you may veer a little bit off of what the standard approach is. So coagulopathy, and the important part of this is standard measures of coagulopathy underestimate your bleeding risk on ECMO. So efforts to avoid bleeding are particularly important, and I completely agree with the previous speaker's comments regarding heparin is not an absolute necessity for extended periods of time with modern circuits, and antifibrinolytic therapy should be used liberally when necessary. Independent of everything else, VA ECMO, I think, is associated with more bleeding than VV ECMO, and that may be helpful to guide when interventions are appropriate or when waiting for decannulation are appropriate. And then the last thing is venous air embolism. So this is particularly true if you want to open up a retroperitoneal hematoma in a patient who's been cannulated for veno-venous ECMO and you think there's any possibility of IVC injury. So by decompressing that RP hematoma, you may expose the a cannula to air, and you may actually suck enough air in to collapse the circuit. So I would just caution against fully opening an RP hematoma, particularly in an area where you think the injury is. This is also particularly pertinent to venous injuries and trauma when just opening the belly. You'd be amazed how much air you can suck in through a relatively small vein. So these are things just to be cautious of and to avoid, particularly high RPM and high flow while on support. With that, I'll take any questions. Thanks.